with a hard, round belly, and the full extent of his tattoos was now revealed. He was a canvas, his body neatly divided into light and dark, the artistry marred only by the black swipe that had been drawn across his eyes. Crodans were prudish and bathed in private, but Ossians did most things in groups and were unashamed about their bodies. Nudity was unremarkable to them, and they found it strange that their neighbours worried about it so much. They bathed together as families, and communal bathhouses could be found in every Ossian town. Indeed, older Ossians sometimes refused to do business anywhere else. They had a proverb, "You don't know a person's heart till you've seen their skin." Stripped of finery, everyone was equal there, and it was one of the diminishing number of places where you were unlikely ever to see a Crodan. The men occupied one side of the tub, while Vikr sat on the other, with Ruck curled up on the floor nearby. Baths were mixed more often than not, with a rope dividing the genders, or, as here, a polite gap. Aaron had been taught to think of the Ossian way of bathing as uncouth. In Croda, only prostitutes and low women showed a lot of flesh. But as much as he'd admired Crodan ways, he always found bathing by himself lonely and boring, and it was hard to avoid communal bathing and swimming when most of your friends were Ossian and you lived by the sea. Now, as he soaked in water hot enough to boil an eel, sweat trickling across his scalp, he wondered why anyone would want to do it any other way. They'd won this respite together. It was only right they should enjoy it together too. "This is the first hour of the rest of my life," he thought. His face still hurt from the beating Garrick had given him, but not enough to ruin his mood. He'd fulfilled his promise to Cade, seen him through horror and hardship to safety. The world had done its worst, and he'd overcome it. He felt a deep calm, a new confidence in himself. There was a splash from behind him, Fen washing herself down. Bathers were expected to clean themselves before soaking in the tub, and for that purpose there was a sunken stone trench and a well, where buckets of mountain water from an underground stream had been drawn up ready. Aaron averted his gaze as she padded over to the tub, but he was surprised by how readily his imagination filled in for his eyes. The girls he was drawn to had always been joyful, teasing and curvy, and Fen was the opposite. Yet even though he mastered the urge to look at her, it took an effort of will to do it. He turned to Cade, seeking something to distract himself. "I think I might never get out of this bath," he said.
"Huh?"
said Cade. He was mesmerised, his face slack, gawping at Fen as she slipped into the bath next to Vika. Aaron shoved him on the shoulder. Cade jerked out of his trance, saw Aaron grinning at him and blushed. "Lost you there for a minute," Aaron said, then lowered his voice to a whisper. "Anyone ever told you it's bad manners to stare in a bathhouse?" Cade scowled and huffed.
"I was thinking, that's all."
"I bet you were.
What happened to Astra, then? Remember her?"
"What happened to Sora?" Cade countered acidly. "Remember her? Squarehead pain in the arse who had you under her thumb and nobody knew what you saw in her." Aaron laughed. "Fair enough. I suppose they're both in the past now. Shoal Point's in the past. The future's what we've got to look forward to, and it's as changeable as steam." He waved a hand in the air to illustrate his point, setting the haze over the water to billowing. But Cade's attention had already drifted back to Fen. Aaron gave up. He recognised the signs of infatuation. Cade was lost. Fen noticed Cade staring and met his gaze coolly. He responded with one of his extra-wide smiles he reserved for girls he'd set his heart on. It was a grin of such gormless width and surpassing idiocy that Aaron feared the top of his head would fall off. Fen looked faintly startled by it. Keel, who was sitting with his elbows on the edge of the tub, threw back his head and began to sing. His voice was deep and surprisingly mellifluous, and it rang from the damp walls.
"Borek he were a wailing sort, sing hey-ho, hey-ho,
a lusty lad with an appetite and a keen shot with a harpoon.
It was a shanty Aaron was vaguely familiar with, having heard it drunkenly bellowed from the fishermen's inns in Shoal Point more than once. Cade nudged him excitedly. Being a dockside boy, he recognised it too.
"A tale I'll tell of a whale he sought, sing hey-ho, hey-ho, a tale of revenge and rage and spite, and the journey that brung him to doom."
Unexpectedly, Garrick joined in then, his rough, phlegmy voice a salty accompaniment to Keel's smooth bass.
"Hey-ho, hey-ho, stay abed, Borwick. Hey-ho, hey-ho, the seas are cold, all right. Hey-ho, hey-ho, your maiden's arms will warm you. Hey-ho, hey-ho, don't you sail tonight."
Cade began singing along uncertainly as they swung into the next verse, dredging the words up from his memory. "Well, Borwick, he hunted a dreadful whale, sing hey-ho, hey-ho, a monstrous beast of terrible size, and he swore to bring it to land. 'Twas 90 feet from nose to tail, sing hey-ho, hey-ho, out of the water it did rise, and its teeth went snap on his hand." Now Cade joined in, too, and Vicar and Grubb sang along to the hey-hos, even though they didn't know the rest of the words. The rhythm, the joyous pull of the song was infectious. Aaron found himself wanting to sing, though he'd never been able to hold a tune.
"Hey-ho, hey-ho, stay abed, Borwick. Hey-ho, hey-ho, the seas are cold, all right. Hey-ho, hey-ho, your master's arms will warm you. Hey-ho, hey-ho, don't you sail tonight." Half a man he returned to port, sing hey-ho, hey-ho. He raised a toast to his missing paw, and his mates drank a jar to his wound. "I'll rest no more till that whale is caught, sing hey-ho, hey-ho. His wife begged him to sail no more, but he launched by the light of the moons."
As the third chorus approached, Aaron could hold back no longer. Even Fenn got swept up in it.
"Hey-ho," they hollered and sang in raucous discord with grins on their faces.
Grubb splashed the water with his hand, and Garrick thumped on the side of the tub with his fist. Ruck, who'd woken up, ran in circles and barked.
"A dreadful storm blew up that night, sing hey-ho, hey-ho. The wind did blow and the waves did crash, and the whale it breached to his aft. 'Twixt man and beast was a deadly fight, sing hey-ho, hey-ho. Then the whale flicked his tail with a mighty splash, and Borwick went down with his craft."
"Hey-ho," they roared again. Steam billowed and water slopped over the side. Aaron sang at the top of his lungs, not caring who heard him or what they thought. A giddy sense of release swept over them. They were here, now, alive against all the odds. Naked, unguarded, they sang together, and Aaron felt the barriers collapse between them. In that moment, they were his companions, his friends, and they were all in it together.
"This tale I tell to caution ye, sing hey-ho, hey-ho. Avenging heart will see you dead and set your wife to weep. A foolish man to fight the sea, sing hey-ho, hey-ho. Now Borwick's found another bed down in the watery deep. Hey-ho, hey-ho, stay abed, Borwick. Hey-ho, hey-ho, the seas are cold, all right. Hey-ho, hey-ho, your maiden's arms will warm you. Hey-ho, hey-ho, don't you sail tonight."
The last chorus was the loudest of all, and ended with a cheer and laughter. Ruck barked at them, and even Garrick was smiling.
"You don't know a person's heart till you've seen their skin," Aaron thought.
And for this brief time at least, all their hearts were happy. 48. So, the king summoned Jasper to his castle, and met him in his throne room, with all the nobles of the land assembled. Cade took a bite from the chicken leg in his hand, swaying slightly as he surveyed his audience. Mouth still full, he raised his voice theatrically as he took on the role of the king.
"You've slain the dragon that has plagued my lands, restored my fortune, and rid me of my treacherous half-brother. Ask and I will grant you any boon. Titles, a castle, a chest of gold."
Aaron wiped his mouth on his sleeve for lack of a napkin. His belly was full to bursting, he was nicely drunk, and he was enjoying the show.
The table before him was crowded with platters that had once held roasted birds, crackly bacon, fluffy potatoes with crunchy skins, warm bread and dripping, cheese and apples and pickles. There was little left of it now. The others lounged in their chairs, sated, jolly with ale, and ready to be entertained with a story of Jasper the accidental dawn warden. Only Grubb was distracted. He was devouring a marmalade-encrusted ham hock with terrifying industry.
"My liege!" Cade cried.
His imitation of Jasper's boozy slurring was all the more convincing because it was only half-faked.
"All these things I have done, I admit, but they were not my intention. A giant raven stole my steak pie while it cooled on the sill, you see. All that followed was in service of one goal alone, to get my delicious pie back from that thieving bag of feathers. So if you would grant me one boon, let it be this. Lend me 100 men, and I will find that raven, put paid to his evil ways, and get back the pie that has so long eluded my jaws."
Keel cackled to himself at that, and Vika chuckled, but Aaron knew the real punchline was still to come.
"At this, the king was bewildered," Cade went on. "But it has been a year and a day since your quest began," he said. "That pie is surely eaten, and even if it is not, its crust must be so hard that the stone mother herself would chip her teeth on it. If you will give up your quest, I will give you my youngest daughter Alessa's hand in marriage. Her beauty is renowned throughout Embria, her wit will delight you, and her grace shames the stars, it is said."
"My liege," said Jasper, "that's all well and good, but can she cook?"
The others roared with laughter, and Keel pounded the table. Grubb looked up from his ham hock, startled, worried that he'd missed something important while he'd been concentrating on his dinner. They applauded as Cade gave a little bow, then he sat back down next to Aaron and reclaimed his ale.
"I swear you told me that story once," Aaron murmured to him. "But as I recall, the hero was called Goyle the Unfortunate, and everyone in it was Croden."
Cade shrugged and grinned into his flagon.
"Reckon I know my audience."
Aaron threw an arm round his shoulders.
"You're a good friend. Did I ever tell you that?"
"Aye, but I can always hear it again,"
said Cade, and reached for a hunk of bread and some cheese. Aaron sat back, stuffed and pleasantly hazy. Beyond the latticed windows the hills were dark. Lamps had been lit, and fires burned brightly in two hearths. There was a bar at one end, behind which stood the lanky Zulan who owned the place, his skin black and shiny as obsidian. Serving girls scurried briskly around him. There were other travellers here, perhaps 24 in all. They clustered round the fires, huddled in shadowy booths, or loafed at the bar. A pair of drunks in tatty cloth coifs and fingerless gloves shared a flask of plum liquor. Three Boscan merchants murmured together, their strange clothes making them look like hunched desert beetles. Their faces were hidden by domed hoods of stiffened hide, so that only their noses and beards showed in the dim light, and pungent smoke rose from the exotic cigars they smoked. In a corner, a Croden family and their Brunlander bodyguard ate quietly. At the back of the room, a sard lutist was tuning up, while an armoured Harish man who shared her table surveyed the room with a stern gaze.
"I've never seen so many different peoples in one place," thought Aaron.
The world he'd known growing up in Shoal Point felt small and far away now. Of them all, it was the sard his eye was drawn to. She was beautiful, with a drowsy elegance about her, and she wore complex layers of lace and patterned cloth. Tiny silver ornaments were sewn into her sleeves, and little chains of them hung round her wrists and ankles. Her ears were pierced many times with studs and rings. Black hair tumbled down her back, held there by combs and pins of chalcedony and amber. Her skin was a shade darker than the Ossian norm. Sards always looked tanned, as if from an outdoor life. But her eyes gave away her origins. Her irises were so green they almost glowed, the unmistakable mark of her kind. She began to play, plucking delicate arpeggios while her fingers spidered and slid across the fretboard. A few of the patrons looked up from their drinks, mildly interested. It was only when she sang that people really started to pay attention. Her voice was husky and warm and smooth, too exceptional to ignore. As Aaron watched her, his thumb absently rubbed the mark on his wrist. The song was a rolling, swooping folk tune from the misty forests of Trine, far to the northeast. It was the story of two brothers competing for the love of their cold-hearted father by goading each other to ever greater acts of valour until, inevitably, tragedy occurred. Trinish history was littered with such tales. They were a warrior people, argumentative and violent by nature, which was why there was rarely peace and stability in their land. Even now they were locked in a civil war to settle their succession, while trying to fight off the encroaching Eleru in Peth, and squabbling with the Quins for the best fishing spots in the White Sea. "Just like us," he thought, "always pulling in different directions." Just like at Salt Fork, or during the centuries of disorder before the Crodans came. The Ossians weren't warlike, as the Trinish were, but they were fiercely opinionated and didn't take orders well, at least not until the Crodans forced them to. They prized their families, good food and loud conversation over discipline and obedience. Getting Ossians to do anything en masse was akin to herding cats. "But we weren't always like that. We fought our way out of slavery and built the greatest empire the East has ever seen. Why couldn't we do it again?" He caught himself before he could follow that line of thought to its end. Just the idea made his chest swell with an unfamiliar pride, and that scared him. Now wasn't the time for heroic dreams, when they'd only just escaped the clutches of the Crodans. Garrick's plan, whatever its details, was doomed to fail. Why hitch themselves to a burning cart? They weren't going to fight the Crodans. You couldn't fight the Crodans. They weren't grey cloaks, just a couple of boys looking to keep their heads down and start again. He glanced at Cade. At least, he hoped that was the case.
"Ah, here's the sweet wine," Keel said, as a serving girl approached their table with a tray. "Make some space."
They cleared a spot on the table, and the girl set down a stone jar with 7 stone cups. Stone was traditional when toasting those who'd returned to the earth. Garrick poured for them all and stood to pass out the cups. Grubb tried to neck his immediately, but Vika slapped a hand on his wrist to stop him. When they all had a cup, Garrick raised his, and the others did the same. Grubb copied them resentfully.
"Tarvi, Vala, Otten, Dox, Osman."
Garrick said each of their names slowly, his expression grim and his eyes far away.
"Good people. All. People who believed in something. Who thought to make things better than they are. I knew none of them as well as I'd have liked to, but for a time they were brothers and sisters of mine."
He moved his cup towards his lips, and they were all about to drink when he held up a hand. He wasn't finished. For a few moments he struggled with what he had to say.
"Their dying is on me," he said at last, his voice hard as he forced out the words. "They followed me, though they didn't know the reason why, and did it willingly. But it was my oath, my responsibility. I should have shouldered it alone, and they're dead because I didn't."
His eyes flickered to Aaron, then away again.
"That's all I want to say. Sala's grace be on them."
He swallowed his drink and sat down.
"Sala's grace be on them," echoed the others, all except Grubb, who was just happy to be allowed to drink at last.
Aaron watched Garrick over the rim of his cup as he finished his sweet wine. Did he just admit he was wrong? That none of this was my fault? There was a somber pause as they thought of the men and women they'd lost. Then Keel clapped his hands.
"Who's for another round? It ain't Amberline, but it'll do."
"Grubb is," Grubb cried, but Keel was already pouring.
They reckon Prince Otico won't have any sweet wine but Amberline at his table, Cade told them knowledgeably. Keel and Garrick exchanged a quick look at the mention of the prince.
Is that so? Said Keel. I didn't know that.
Nor I,
said Garrick, studying Cade thoughtfully. Aaron turned his cup around in his hand, a wistful look in his eye. My father used to like Amberline, he said. Then he saw Garrick's expression and realized what he'd said. Merely mentioning his father was enough to raise Garrick's hackles. Well, damn him. He'd speak of his father if he wanted. In fact, he'd do more than that. I never drank to him, Aaron said suddenly. Never had the chance to, till now. He got to his feet, hot with defiance, and raised his cup. My father, fallen to a Crodan blade. It may be I never knew who he really was, but he was a good man to me, and I loved him. The table was silent. They sensed the tension there. Aaron held the older man's gaze as he said, Sarla's grace be on him, and drank.
Sarla's grace be on him, echoed Vika, and she drank too.
Cade was wary of Garrick's wrath, but his hesitation lasted only an instant.
Sarla's grace be on him.
He downed his cup quickly, before he could have second thoughts. Fenn went next, and then Grubb. This time he said the words along with the others. Only Keel and Garrick were left. Keel gave his friend a long look. Let it go, he was saying. It doesn't matter. Garrick was impassive. Do as you will. So Keel shrugged and drank.
Sarla's grace be on him.
Garrick slowly pushed the full cup away from him and got to his feet. He didn't look angry, but weary instead.
Ought to see about fixing us some transport, he rumbled.
Yes, Grubb said. Grubb want to know what adventures he's getting into next. Grubb still got a lot of skin to cover.
Garrick said nothing to that. He only walked away. The others said nothing either. The skull clearly didn't understand. Garrick didn't want him as a companion, nor did Aaron, in truth. Just because they'd shared the road for some way, it didn't make them friends. They all fell into their own private conversations after that. Cade leaned close to Aaron and opened his mouth to speak, but Aaron intercepted him. I know what you're going to say. You don't want to leave, do you?
Why should we? Cade said. They're an all right bunch, aren't they?
He saw Aaron's expression and quickly backtracked.
I mean, aside from Garrick punching your face in that time. But he's sorry, look at him. He's just too gruff and beardy to say it.
Beardy?
Well, he is.
Cade, Aaron fought to put his feelings into words straightforward enough for his friend to understand.
I hate him. Don't you see that? Everything that's happened to us has been down to him.
Ain't true, said Cade, raising a finger. Who killed your da?
Crodans. Who sent us to rot in a work camp? Crodans. You always were slow to blame the squareheads for what they're rightfully responsible. Now, if you ask me who saved us when we had the choice of getting torn up by skull dogs or stepping off a cliff...
Yes, you've made your point, Aaron said waspishly. He knew it was true, but knowing that didn't change a thing. It was so much easier to hate Garrick, who was surly and violent and hated him back, than it was to hate a whole nation whose beliefs he'd been taught to admire and share.
We had a plan, remember? He said. Get to safety, then see where the wind takes us. All of Ossia awaits us. I thought you wanted to be an actor.
Aye, but that was before, said Cade.
They're doing something noble, something right. They're fighting for our country, and they need our help.
Help? Aaron scoffed. You can't even swing a sword, and I'm no warrior. How could we help?
Dunno, said Cade, pushing a pickle around his plate. But I know my da would be right proud if he heard I'd joined the rebels.
Aaron sobered at that. Sometimes he forgot Cade still had a stake in Shoal Point. Aaron's bridges had all burned when his father died, but Cade still had family there. What agonies his parents must have suffered,
not knowing the fate of their only son.
"Do you miss them?"
Aaron asked. Cade shrugged.
"Da, not really. Ma, I missed her sore when we were in the camp, but since then not so much. Feels good to be on the move, you know? Any direction as long as it's away from there."
He frowned slightly as a thought occurred to him.
"Be meaning to write them a letter, though, when we get ourselves sorted. Reckon you could help me with that?"
"Of course. What do you think you'll say?"
"Oh, I don't know. That everything's all right and I'm making my way in the world. And I'll tell Da where he can stick his god's damn chisels and saws."
He grinned. Aaron's gaze found Garrick over at the bar, deep in conversation with the innkeeper. The Zulan was perhaps in his 40s, perhaps his 60s, it was hard to tell. He wore a purple waistcoat too fine for working in, and there was something courtly about the way he stood and the gestures he made. Likely he'd come from wealthy stock. Zulan highborns were notorious fops. Aaron wondered how he ended up managing a remote inn in occupied Ossia.
"Listen," said Aaron, "I know you like the idea of what Garrick stands for, but he's a hunted man, hunted by dreadknights. We've no worth to the Crodans, we were just bait. Nobody's after us now. We can do anything, be anything. Isn't that what you always wanted?"
"I suppose," said Cade gloomily. His eyes were on Fenn, smiling and relaxed, as she talked with Keel, made loose by food and drink. When Cade fell for a girl, he fell fast and hard. It wouldn't be easy to make him leave her.
"It's not our decision anyway," Aaron said. "He doesn't want us."
"You could change his mind," Cade said optimistically. "You always know how to persuade people." Aaron began to despair of letting his friend down lightly. Blinded as he was by his new infatuation, he didn't see that this wouldn't work, couldn't work.
"Besides," said Cade, as a new point occurred to him, "don't you want to know who your father really was? The only one who can tell you is Garrick."
"And for that I should lash myself to him until he decides I'm allowed to know?" Aaron said, more sharply than he'd intended. Cade looked hurt. Aaron softened.
"Sorry," he said. "Something prevents him from telling me, I don't know what. And even if I could make him, I doubt I'd like what he has to say. But I'll think on it."
He waved his hand then, dashing the subject away.
"Ah, be gone with all these decisions," he said, louder now there was no need for secrecy. "Here's ale and sweet wine, good food and good company. Let tonight be tonight and tomorrow be tomorrow."
Cade gave him a mischievous smile.
"Time was you thought Ossian sayings like that were just for us bumpkins."
"Well, then call me a
bumpkin, Grub yelled in a wave of beery breath.
He cackled and took a swig from his flagon, well pleased with himself. The lutist had finished her song to scattered applause and taken her seat to retune. Aaron saw his opportunity and got to his feet.
"Where are you off to?"
Cade asked, but Aaron was already heading across the common room.
When Keel saw his direction, he yelled,
"You don't think you've got a chance with her, do you?"
loud enough for everyone to hear. Aaron blushed to the roots of his hair and walked faster. The lutist's companion stood as Aaron approached, placing himself between them. He was very tall, clad in a fine splint mail shirt that was probably expensive, and polished greaves and braces. A longsword hung at his hip, and his hand stayed near it. But though his size was intimidating, his features were not. His head seemed too small for his body. He had hardly a chin to speak of, and his mouth was small and puckered. His dark brown hair was bowl-cut above his ears, and his expression was fixed in an attitude of haughty blandness.
"Halt," he said. "Approach no further."
His voice was high and fluting. If Aaron hadn't already guessed he was from Harrow by his hair and his ramrod straight stance, his crisp accent and superior tone would have given it away.
"Be calm," said the lutist.
Her speaking voice was silken and low, with the sing-song lilt of her people.
"You are too protective."
His expression changed not one bit. After an uncomfortable pause, he stepped aside, but he kept his hand near his sword.
"Sit, please," she said to Aaron. "I am Orica, and this is Harod."
"Aaron," he said, before he could consider the wisdom of providing his real name. He cursed himself for his lack of wit, but her beauty had flustered him. He remembered the tales of illusions and bewitchments that the young men and women of Shoal Point brought back from their visits to Sard campsites, and resolved to be more careful. He pulled out a stool, scraping it awkwardly along the floor, and sat. Harod loomed at his shoulder, silently threatening. Aaron was suddenly conscious of the fading bruises that still discoloured his face. He looked rough and unkempt in his battered travel clothes, even after his bath. Small wonder Harod was cautious.
I very much enjoyed your music," he said politely.
"Thank you," she said with a tilt of her head. "I'm surprised you could hear it over your companions." Aaron looked sheepish. "Were we that loud?"
"I am teasing. No music is finer than the sound of people enjoying themselves. Life is laughter, yes?"
"I like that idea," said Aaron. "There's been little enough laughter of late.
All the more reason to treasure it."
He glanced nervously at Harod. "Have you journeyed far?" She finished tuning her lute and turned her sleepy green gaze upon him.
"I have been away a long time," she said. 5 years as an apprentice to a master bard, travelling Embria and gathering songs as we went. 2 years playing for the high houses of Harrow. That's where I met Harod."
She smiled up at him. "He is my most faithful friend and my guardian in these troubled times."
"Speak your business, boy," Harod demanded. "He also has a marked lack of patience with strangers," she said pointedly, giving him a harder look.
The slightest bobbing of his throat was the only outward sign that he was chastened.
"I won't keep you from your performance," said Aaron quickly. "I just have one question. Do you need any help?"
She laughed in surprise.
"Do I look like I do?"
"It's just that, well, I met Asad, and..." He drew back his sleeve to show her the tiny red symbol there. "He gave me this mark."
Orica's eyes widened. "Where did you meet him?" she asked sharply.
This time Aaron thought it best to be cautious. Admitting that he was an escaped prisoner wouldn't be a smart thing to do.
"I can't tell you. He wanted to stay hidden, and I must honour that wish."
Orica seemed to grudgingly approve of that. She took his hand, turning it left and right, studying the mark. "He helped me. When I offered to help him in return, he told me to help another Sard instead." Orica nodded thoughtfully.
"Chled Nasan."
"Yes, he kept saying that."
"It means to pass one's fortune forward, to give it to another. We do not like to let anything go to waste, whether food or favours. If we cannot make use of something, we make sure it goes to someone who can."
"But this is strange ink. Did he tattoo it on your skin?"
"He bit his thumb and pressed it to my wrist. When the blood flaked off, this mark was left behind."
He remembered something.
"He called himself Idral?"
Orica looked stricken.
"Idral."
It was only by contrast that Aaron realized how badly he'd mispronounced it.
"You met an Idral?"
"What is an Id... one of those?"
"Have a care, m'lady," Harod intoned, leaning down to glare at Aaron face to face. "He seeks to trick you. That mark could be faked to win your confidence." "It would take a spy of great craft to know this sign and Idral both, and I am but a bard not worth the effort." She let his hand drop.
"Will you tell me about this mark?" Aaron asked, "and the nature of the boy who gave it to me?" Orica's eyes were guarded.
"I will, because if you are false, then you know the answers anyway, and if you are not, then you deserve to have them. That is the sign of a Sard friend, one who is not of our blood, but who is willing to aid us. Without such a mark,
many of my people would likely not talk to you at all, much less accept help from you. We have become suspicious of late, and with good reason."
Aaron stared at his wrist, perturbed by this new information.
And how do I get it off?"
"You do not want to be a sad friend?" Her voice had taken on an edge.
"No, of course I do, it's just..." He flailed. "Well, after I've done what I promised. I mean, I didn't ask to be marked like this."
"I understand," she said flatly. "Do not fear, young Ossian. None but Sards will recognize it."
Aaron was ashamed at the disgust in her voice. She'd read him right. He didn't really want to be a Sard friend, and he certainly didn't want to declare himself one in public. It was too much of a risk. At best, he'd look untrustworthy and suspicious. At worst, he'd draw the attention of the Crodans. Such arguments seemed reasonable in his head, but they withered in the face of Orica's disdain. She sighed and looked back to her lute.
"I do not know how you would remove that mark. It was put there by an Idral, one of the true blood. They are our seers and mystics, and their powers are strange. When your task is done, perhaps he will remove it himself. Perhaps it will disappear on its own. But I do not need your help, so it must remain there yet. Now, please excuse me. I have neglected my duty tonight." She slipped the lute strap over her head. "Goodbye, sad friend," she said, disappointed.
"You are no longer wanted here," Harrod told him firmly. Aaron didn't need telling. He went back to his table, mortified and humbled by the scorn in the bard's words. It didn't seem fair that he'd been made to feel so small. After all, when he'd implied he didn't want to be a friend to the Sards, he hadn't meant her. She was beautiful and looked kind. He'd only meant, well, the other Sards, the deceitful ones, the swindlers and the liars. Just thinking it made him realize how pathetic that sounded. No wonder she'd been disgusted at him. He was disgusted at himself. Shaking his head, he took a bitter swallow of ale as Orica struck up a new tune.
"No look, eh?" said Keel jovially. But he didn't press the issue, because Garrick returned then. "You and old Rapperpet had a lot to say to each other," Keel observed as Garrick sat down.
"He misses his home. We were discussing the wonders of Zulan military technology, among other things."
He leaned forward over the table and dropped his voice so only those around it could hear.
"Our plans have changed," he said. "Dreadnoughts have been seen on the South Road."
It was like having cold water thrown over them.
"The same three that followed us to Skevengard?" Keel asked. "I don't know, but that road is too dangerous now. It would be a risk to travel so close to Salt Fork anyway. The countryside is still crawling with Crodans. We will take a different route."
He turned to Aaron.
"I've arranged transport for you and Cade to Greenrock. A caravan of merchants is leaving at dawn. I'll pay the Skarl's passage too, he's earned that much. After that, your paths are your own."
Cade looked at Fenn, upset. He hadn't expected the decision to be made for him so soon, nor so firmly.
Grubb was even more distressed. "But the Grubb wants to go with you to do dangerous deeds," he cried.
Garrick ignored that.
"Whither you, Vika?"
"I will go with you," she said, "if you'll have me."
"You do not know what you ask. There will be great risk."
Grubb groaned in exasperation and threw up a dismissive hand.
"I was guided to you, and I cannot ignore that," said Vika. "There are greater forces at play here, and I am set upon a purpose I do not yet understand. My way lies with yours for now."
"Then you are most welcome," said Garrick.
"Why Grubb not most welcome when Painted Lady is?"
Grubb protested, but was ignored again. Garrick tossed a small pouch onto the table. It landed with a chink of coins.
10 guilders for the merchants. Don't let them charge you more," he said to Aaron. "The rest is for you to keep or divide as you wish. It'll get you started wherever you go."
Aaron nodded gravely in thanks. Whatever he felt for this man, it was right to be gracious. "You may have been my father's enemy, but you saved my life more than once, and held to your oath when many would not have. Whatever else you are, you're a man of honour." Garrick grunted, taken aback by the unexpected praise.
"We are none of us responsible for the sins of our fathers. I shouldn't have held yours against you."
He got to his feet.
"Be in the stable yard at sunrise. Speak to Tarpin. I'll say farewell now, for I won't see you again."
He departed without ceremony, leaving the others with the remains of their meal. They looked at one another uncertainly. The atmosphere had turned morose. Aaron realized that neither Keel nor Fenn nor Vika would be happy to see the back of them. Perhaps they'd half hoped they'd all continue on together. Apparently it wasn't to be.
"Let's not get maudlin, eh?" said Keel, and he took up his flagon. "Hallen gave us the perfect remedy for a heavy heart. The night's young, and if it's to be our last altogether, let's not waste it on sadness."
Fenn picked up her own flagon. So did Cade and Vika. Grubb reached surreptitiously across the table for the bag of coins, but Aaron put his hand on it first. "Why don't I keep hold of this?" he said. 49. The sun was cresting the hills to the east as Garrick watched the merchant caravan crawl up the road. The room he shared with Keel faced full into the morning, and the upper panes of the latticed window had turned to dazzling fire. He squinted against the glare, seeking Aaron among the pack, but the men and horses were only silhouettes and he couldn't find him. He was likely inside one of the covered carts in any case.
"That's the end of it then," he thought,
and he felt a stone shift and tumble away from the cairn piled over his heart. His duty had been discharged. Aaron was safe, and he could move on. But nine, the bloody cost of it. He wouldn't dwell on it. If he started counting his losses, he'd never stop. There was only onward, onward, onward. Keep going. Never quit. Never again. The latch rattled and Keel came in.
"You saw them down to the stable yard?" Garrick asked.
"I did," said Keel. "Didn't stay, though. I'm not much for farewells."
He joined Garrick at the window. The caravan was growing smaller in the distance now.
"Was it worth it?" Keel asked. "You ask as if I had a choice."
"Or the men might say you did."
"Other men place little value on their honour."
Keel sat down on the edge of his bed and massaged the back of his neck. He looked none the worse for the night's revels, but then he always could drink like a horse.
"Well, they're on their way, for better or worse. What of our path? You've not changed your mind?" "About the Amber Blade?"
Keel gave a derisive snort, small chance of that.
"About Rackan Bay." "I said we're going, and we are, as soon as we can find someone willing to take us north."
Keel blew out his breath, though whether in relief or trepidation Garrick couldn't tell.
"I'm going home," he said, as if in amazement.
Had he secretly hoped otherwise? Garrick wasn't sure. Returning home was never simple for Keel. He loved his wife and boy as fierce as a man could love, but there were other things waiting for him in Rackan Bay, things he'd taken to the road to avoid because he couldn't bear them any longer. Responsibility, judgment, limits. Every time Keel went back to Rackan Bay, Garrick feared he'd never leave again, that the pull of family would prove stronger than his need for freedom. Keel was the only man he counted a true friend, and losing him to Mariella would be a blow hard to take. But there was no choice this time. Garrick had business in Rackan Bay, business that he couldn't share with anyone, not even Keel.
"Yes, to Rackan Bay we go," he said. "We'll take a ship from there, round the west coast and up the Redwater to Morganholm, where we'll meet Mara and Yaren. We'll lose some time, but it's the safer route." "Better than running into those dreadnights again,"
Keel agreed.
Aye, said Garrick faintly.
The Dreadknights. He wondered where they really were, as despite what he'd told his companions, they weren't on the South Road. Secrets. Lies. It didn't sit well with him to deceive his friend so, but he'd understand. They'd all understand in the end. They headed to the common room, knocking at Fenn and Vika's room on the way.
"They'll be at breakfast already, no doubt," said Keel. "Did you see the druidess last night? She can eat, I'll say that for her. I like that in a woman, eh?"
Garrick gave him a sidelong look.
"What?" Keel protested. "I'm just saying I like a woman who can eat."
"All women can eat, Keel. They'd be dead if they couldn't. You know what I mean."
There were scattered groups around the common room when they arrived, breaking their fast with new-baked bread, bacon and fresh eggs. Garrick saw the Croden family that had been there last night, a pale, meek couple and their children, dwarfed by their hairy Brunlander bodyguard. He searched for Fenn and Vika and found them tucked into a booth in the far corner. They were eating, as Keel had predicted, but not alone. Garrick felt a knot pull tight under his breastbone and heat rise up in his throat. Aaron was there, with Cade and Grub. The Bitterbracker saw them too, and held up his hands in innocence.
"I watched them get on the cart, Garrick."
"Looks like they got off again," he growled. Anger drove him forward as he stamped across the room.
Vika jumped to her feet as she saw him approach, and spoke before he could.
"Is it true?" she asked urgently. "Is it true what Aaron says?"
Garrick turned his gaze onto Aaron. Aaron was looking back with that impertinent, arrogant calm he'd taken on of late. This new fearlessness infuriated him.
"What does Aaron say?" he snapped.
"That you seek to claim the Ember Blade."
Keel spat an oath.
"Will you keep your voice down?"
He looked around in case anyone had overheard, but this booth had been chosen for privacy. By Aaron, no doubt.
"You insidious little bastard."
"The champion with the burning blade," Vika breathed. "The blade that shines like sunlight. It is you."
Garrick didn't know what she was talking about, and he was too incensed to care.
"Who told you?"
he demanded of Aaron, looking at the others to find his betrayer.
"I didn't say a word," said Keel.
Fenn shook her head. "How we know isn't important," said Aaron. "We know, that's all. And now Vika and Grub do, too. I thought a little openness would make a refreshing change."
"You're a fool, boy. A fool who can't keep his mouth shut. So you've endangered us all, put the whole plan in jeopardy. Is that your hope, to ruin us? I shouldn't be surprised. It's in your blood to sell out your own."
The insult had no effect. Aaron looked at him coolly. It was absurd that one so young should be so controlled, so in command. "You're short on bodies," Aaron told him. "I'd say you could use all the help you can get." His meaning dawned on Garrick then.
"You're volunteering?" he asked in disbelief.
"I'm sure you wouldn't want the three of us running round Greenrock, knowing what we do. Crodens might catch us, and who knows what they'd make us say."
"Grub rubbish at keeping secrets," the skull added enthusiastically. "One time, his friend love another man's woman in secret. Grub tell whole town, friend kill himself. Throw himself off cliff, splat, true story."
"As you see," Aaron said, "better if we stick together, so you can keep an eye on us."
"Ha!" said Keel.
Garrick glowered at him, but he just shrugged.
"We are thin on numbers. The Skarl's got his uses, and the boys have brain and guts. They broke out of a Croden work camp on their own, didn't they?"
"You must take them," said Vika. "Can't you see? As I was guided to you, so they were, too. If you are the champion in my vision, then all this was meant to be."
Garrick had great respect for the druids, but that kind of talk sounded like zealotry.
"If this was meant to be, Vika, then the Crodens were also meant to crush us 30 years ago, and Osman was destined to die. Nobody decides my fate."
neither God nor man.
And yet, despite his protests, it was being decided without him. Ever since he'd heard the name of Aaron of Shoal Point, his influence over his companions had been slipping. Fenn was on the edge of leaving already. Even Keel was beginning to doubt him, and there was a real danger he might choose to stay in Rackham Bay. He'd never really believed they could fulfill their mission after they lost Tarvi and Vala and the others. Rejecting Aaron now could be the final straw for him. And no matter how determined Garrick was, he couldn't do it all alone. Aaron was still watching him, waiting for a decision. Nine. How he reminded Garrick of his father then. Crafty enough to outmaneuver him, brave enough to face him down. As much as Garrick had hated that man, he'd loved him as a brother once. Maybe the boy did deserve the chance to stand on his own merit. We are none of us responsible for the sins of our fathers. He wondered if he really believed that. Handbells clanged outside, and they heard the clopping of hooves on the flagstones.
"Hear this, in the name of the Emperor," called a voice in Croden. "Stay where you are, and prepare your passes for inspection."
Keel raised his head in alarm.
"Road patrol."
"But we don't have passes," Cade said.
Garrick grabbed Grubb by the arm and pulled him from the booth.
"Hide," he said. "Don't leave the building. The place is already surrounded, and they'll be looking for runners."
"Grubb good at hiding," Grubb told him. "One time, Grubb hid from—"
"Just go!"
Garrick shoved him towards the door. Another man got up and ran after him. He obviously had no pass either. It wasn't uncommon to risk a journey without the proper authorization, and Mose considered it a very minor crime, but the punishment if caught was still harsh. The other travellers watched them leave. Garrick scanned the room for anyone who might report them. The Ossians and foreigners would likely keep their peace, unless pressed by the inspectors. It was the Croden family that worried him. The father looked at Garrick, sensing his attention. He'd seen Grubb in their group and seen him run. All of them looked guilty now.
"What about us?" Cade asked, afraid. "We didn't exactly have the chance to pick up paperwork while running for our lives from the Dreadnoughts."
"I carry no pass either," said Vika. "I do not need Croden permission to walk in my own land." "Today you do," said Garrick, digging into a pouch at his belt.
He handed her a folded and battered document.
"Your name is Lana of Houndbridge."
To Aaron and Cade he gave two more passes.
"Baron of Oxfell, Dredge of Hog's Wallow."
"Dredge of Hog's Wallow?" Cade whined.
"Shut your mouth, boy. I'm trying to save your life."
He handed passes to Fenn and Keel and took out his own. "Why do you have so many spare?" Aaron asked.
"They were not spare when we met at Sulla's Bluff," said Garrick.
He nodded at Vika.
"That one was Vala's. I have none that would work for the Skarl. His tattoos give him away."
"You will present your passes," said the inspector as he strode into the common room, accompanied by four armoured soldiers in black and white livery.
Footsteps sounded in the corridor as soldiers fanned out through the inn. Two soldiers took station by the entrance. The others stayed close to the inspector as he moved from group to group, studying passes as they were presented, snapping out questions. Soon he came to Garrick.
"Passes,"
he said, holding out a gloved hand. He was a long-faced man, blonde hair combed unconvincingly across a balding scalp. A monocle was sandwiched between eyebrow and cheek.
"Rot in the abyss, you filthy square-haired dog," Garrick thought as he handed over his pass.
The inspector unfolded it and examined the spiky calligraphy, the forged governor's signature, the faked official seal.
"Your business?"
"I'm a guard. We're transporting goods from Bannerport to Morganholm."
"These passes are almost expired. You'll not make Morganholm in 2 days.
"A broken axle delayed us. We will stop at Arkencross tomorrow to apply for an extension from the governor."
"See that you do," he said. He folded up the pass, handed it back,
and motioned to the others with the peremptory arrogance of the officious. "Now the rest." They produced their passes. "That's quite a wound you have on your neck," he observed, as he shuffled disinterestedly through them. "How did you get it?"
"Low men waylaid me in my younger days, cut my throat and left me for dead. The land was lawless before the Emperor came."
The inspector looked up sharply, alert for signs of sarcasm or mockery. Garrick gave him none. "Indeed it was," the inspector agreed. "Hail to the Emperor."
"Hail to the Emperor,"
Garrick said, as the inspector returned their passes. Now the inspector walked over to the Croden family. "Good morning, young fellow," he said, as he ruffled the boy's blonde hair. Then to his father. "May I see your identity documents and a pass for the Brunlander?"
"Nine, he's got a better attitude when he's dealing with Crodens," Keel muttered.
Garrick wasn't listening. He was staring at the father, who was casting uneasy looks in their direction as he showed his documents.
"Say nothing," Garrick thought at him. "He hasn't asked. Don't tell."
"Everything appears to be in order," said the inspector, barely glancing at the paperwork before he handed it back. The father took them with a weak smile, then drew a quick breath. A decision made, he was about to speak.
"Here it comes," thought Garrick, and his hand moved towards his sword.
The father saw it. His gaze flicked to his son and daughter, sitting opposite. He swallowed the words down again.
"Thank you, Inspector," he said, looking faintly ill.
"That's right. Keep your mouth shut," Garrick thought. "You don't want a sword fight in here."
A soldier hurried into the room. "Inspector, we found a sard in the stable yard trying to leave. Her companion is giving us trouble."
"Stay in your seats, all of you," the inspector barked at the room, and he left with the soldiers following him.
Once he was gone, the travellers in the common room began to mutter between themselves again. Keel relaxed and let out a low whistle of relief.
"Thought for a moment there he wouldn't believe us."
Aaron surged up from the table. "They're going to arrest her," he blurted.
"So what?" asked Cade.
"They'll take her away, like they did to those sards at the camp."
"That's what happens when they arrest people, Aaron. We should know it happened to us."
Aaron clenched and unclenched his fists, looking towards the door in evident agitation. "She needs our help," he said, and then he was past Garrick and running towards the exit.
"Oi! The inspector said to stay here," Cade called.
"He'll get us all caught," said Keel. "Still glad he didn't leave with the merchants," Garrick growled, and they set off after him.
50. "I am a knight of Harrow and a scion of High House Anselm," Harrod's voice rang out across the yard, "and this lady is under my protection." A small crowd had gathered around the cobbled yard. Others watched the commotion from the gallery. In the gate of an empty stall, Harrod had taken up a combat stance that looked at best theatrical, at worst ridiculous. 5 Croden soldiers stood before him. Orica sheltered nervously behind. Nearby, a cart had been hitched up to 2 horses that were now being held by stable boys. Garrick presumed they'd been caught trying to leave.
"Get up on the balcony," he told Fenn. "We may need your bow. The rest of you, stick close."
They pushed their way to the front of the crowd, where Garrick seized Aaron by the arm.
"What's in your head, boy? This isn't our fight."
Aaron pulled away from him with the sullen fury of the young. Garrick let him go. A struggle here would attract attention.
"When will it be our fight?" Aaron demanded.
"When the time is right. Pick your battles. There are more important things at stake here than some sard, no matter how pretty you think her."
Aaron gave him a look of disgust, but though he was desperate to do something, there was nothing to be done.
"Let's just shoot the fool," said a crossbowman to Garrick's right, his weapon aimed and ready.
"Hold," said the soldier next to him. "He says he's a Harish noble. You don't want to upset the apple cart right before the prince's wedding, not with the emperor trying to make an alliance."
The crossbowman spat in the dirt.
"'He's on Croden soil now,' he said, but he didn't fire. "'The inspector walked out into the yard "'and put his fist across his chest in salute. "'Hail to the Emperor!' he declared loudly, addressing Harold. "'If you are indeed who you say you are, "'then you're a civilized man. "'Put up your sword. "'There is no need for violence.' "'You shall not have her,' said Harold, "'his eyes never leaving the men arrayed against him. "'If she has the correct paperwork, "'she will be allowed to continue on her way. "'If not, she will be detained. "'There is nothing to fear if you've done nothing wrong. "'In this land, that has not been true for a long time.' "'The inspector stiffened. "'He glanced around at the waiting crowd. "'His air of authority was slipping, and his temper with it. "'This land is part of the Croden Empire,' he said, "'a note of indignity creeping into his voice. "'And we follow the rule of law here. "'I say again, put up your sword. "'We will show you no mercy if you do not. "'Neither you nor the Sard you protect.' "'Garrick didn't miss the distaste in the inspector's voice. "'Sard. "'Harrod didn't miss it either. "'Tell me, Inspector,' Harrod said with that unwavering, haughty calm. "'What law protects the Sards? "'We have been to Addisport, Tatterfane, Maresmouth. "'Once there were hundreds of Sards in those towns. "'Now there are none. "'Disappeared almost overnight and taken east in secret. "'Where do you send them? "'To the ghetto in Morgenholm? "'Is that where you will send Milady?' "'The inspector's nostrils flared.' That was too much defiance to be borne in public. You have refused to obey a representative of the Emperor before all these good citizens. Your noble birth does not entitle you to act like a criminal here. One last time. Put up your sword, or I will have you both executed. Harod, said Orica, do as he says. You can't fight them all. And surrender, milady, to whatever fate they have in store? I think not. He raised his voice. "'Come at me, then, if you must, but you will pay a heavy price for it.' "'As you wish,' said the inspector. "'Kill him!' The soldiers edged closer, keeping him at sword's length. The crossbowman to Garrick's right sighted but didn't fire. "'They're in the way,' he muttered. "'There's five of them,' said his companion. "'He won't last long.' One of the soldiers lunged. Harrod tapped his blade aside, ran him neatly through, and reverted to the same awkward, constipated fighting stance as before.
"'Four now,' said Garrick, unable to resist.
"'Kill him!' the inspector yelled, his face reddening. Soldiers ran in from the crowd to join their fellows, including the crossbowman's companion. Garrick saw a second crossbowman nearby, circling for a shot. Now they all set upon Harrod together. He'd chosen his spot well, for with the wooden walls of the stall to either side, they could only approach two at a time. His sword flicked this way and that, his movements coiled, economical and disciplined. The Harish fighting style was designed to frustrate, a patiently defensive art aimed at luring the enemy into overextending themselves. When they did, they died. It was quickly plain that he was an expert at it. Another Croden soldier dropped at Harrod's feet. His companion, angered by the sight, pressed harder and got a blade in the belly for his trouble. But now there were a dozen soldiers moving in on him, and he couldn't win against those odds. He'd be killed soon enough, though Garrick couldn't help admiring him for putting up such a fight.
"'We have to do something,' Aaron said.
"'It's not our business,' said Garrick.
Aaron was rubbing at an odd mark on his wrist. "'Assad helped me escape that camp. I'd never have got out if not for him.'
"'Dying's a poor way to honour his efforts,' said Garrick. "'World's a bad place, and sometimes you have to turn away. You can't stop this.'
"'I owe him a debt.'
"'Boy, you know nothing of debts.'
"'I know what lengths you went to in order to pay yours.' Garrick let that pass. The fight around the stable stall had become a bloody farce for the Crodans. Two men were dead, and another was screaming and holding in his guts as blood spurted across the cobbles. Those behind him were trying to step over their fallen, while Harrod fended away any who came near.
The inspector's fury grew as he saw some Ossians in the crowd daring to smirk.
"Make space, you moonwits!" he shouted at his men. "Crossbows, take aim!"
Aaron's hand was clasped around the hilt of his sword, his pulse jumping at his neck.
"Turn away," Garrick warned.
"I can't," said Aaron, and he surged forward with a cry, drawing his sword.
"Aaron, don't!"
Cade cried from behind him.
"I knew he had a death wish," Keel muttered, and he muscled out of the crowd, pulling his own blade as he ran after Aaron.
"So be it," thought Garrick, and a flare of eager violence lit in his breast. He barged sideways, knocking into the crossbowman on his right. The trigger clicked, the bowstring thumped, and the quarrel meant for Harrod buried itself in the meat of a soldier's arm instead. The second crossbowman, who also had Harrod in his sights, hesitated as he heard the soldier scream. Fenn shot him through the neck from above, and he fell gargling, his crossbow firing harmlessly into the cobbles. Garrick wrapped his arm around the first crossbowman's throat and pulled him roughly onto his waiting dagger. He plunged it in three times, then let the man drop and drew his sword, his blood igniting in his veins.
"For Ossia!"
he roared, his blade held high. Then he charged. The inspector scrambled back into the crowd as Aaron, Keel, and Garrick laid into the soldiers from the rear. Aaron reached them first and caught his target by surprise. The soldier was still turning when Aaron plunged a sword through his ribs. Boy and man stood shocked and still, one realizing what he'd done, the other what had been done to him. Then the soldier toppled, pulling the sword from Aaron's numb hands. Aaron stumbled back, dazed and appalled. The boy was no killer. He wasn't used to death up close, or the look in a man's eyes as he died. A Croden soldier bore down on him, his blade raised. Garrick moved to intercept, but before he could, an arrow punched through the soldier's cheeks. It was Fenn, still shooting from above. The soldier dropped his sword and staggered back, pawing at his face, blood spilling over his lips. Garrick decapitated him while he was defenseless. The crowd scattered, screaming and shouting, running for the safety of the inn. Stable boys fled this way and that. Garrick pulled Aaron behind him.
"Stay back, boy. You've done enough."
He ran to join Keel, and together they laid into the soldiers, while Harrod pressed the advantage from the other side. The Crodans panicked as they found themselves surrounded, their discipline crumbling, and after that they were mere meat for the cutting. Garrick hacked and stabbed, hot blood spattering his cheek as his blade bit bone. He gave a cry of exultation and hate, swept up in the joyous throes of killing. He was unleashed now, and nine how he wished he could slaughter them all this way, how he wished every Croden could die at his hand. But the fight was all too brief, and as suddenly as it had begun, it was over. Garrick stood panting among the corpses. The stable yard had emptied, the surviving soldiers put to flight. The man with the belly wound was still groaning weakly on the ground. Garrick put a sword in him with less thought than he'd give to slaying a chicken. He straightened and glanced over at Aaron. The boy looked sick.
"Pick up your sword," Garrick told him. "You killed a man, that's all. You'll do worse than that if you mean to follow me."
Aaron wavered for an instant, then his face firmed. He stooped, pulled his sword out of the dead soldier, and sheathed it again.
"Thank you for your aid," said Harrod formally, "but it was not required. I had the matter in hand."
Keel laughed in disbelief.
"You'd have had a crossbow bolt in each eye, Harrow man."
"I beg to differ."
"He begs to differ," said Keel flatly, looking at Garrick. "Beg all you like and save your thanks," Garrick told Harrod. "Those Crodans will be back with reinforcements. We'd best not be here when they do."
He eyed the cart, hitched and idle at the edge of the yard, the horses stamping nervously at the smell of blood.
"That's yours?"
"Out of the question," Harrod said. "We travel alone.
"What Harrod means to say," said Orica, emerging from the stall behind him, "is that we are deeply grateful for your help, and it would be our honour to have you travel with us to Morgenholm, in return for your protection on the journey. Isn't that right, Harrod?"
"Milady,"
Harrod protested, "I am quite capable of defending you myself." She laid a hand on his arm.
"I know you are," she said gently.
"But there's no harm in a little help, yes? And these people are no friends of the Crodans." Her green eyes found Aaron. Garrick caught her look and wondered what had passed between them last night in the common room, but now wasn't the time to ask. The battle fury was leaking away, leaving him trembling, and they needed to go.
"Fortune smiles on us," he said. "The capital is our destination, too. But the way south is too dangerous now. We plan a safer route, first north and then by sea."
Orica inclined her head. "That is wise," she said. "We will go that way." Harrod said nothing. The slightest tick of his right eye was the only sign of his anger. Garrick cared nothing for his feelings, as long as he didn't oppose them.
"Well and good, then," said Garrick. "Now where's that cursed skull got to?"
A door at the edge of the stable yard was booted open, and Grubb emerged, dragging the corpse of the inspector by the arm. He dumped the body on the cobbles and dusted off his hands.
"What did you kill him for?" Cade asked. "He was running away."
"Grubb didn't like his face," he said.
Then he popped the inspector's monocle over one eye and grinned a crooked grin.
"One less Croden to burden the world," said Garrick. "But enough escaped that could recognize us. Get your packs, all of you. We're leaving."
He set off across the yard. Aaron stared at him hollowly as he approached.
"I had to do it," Aaron said, as if Garrick had asked for an explanation.
"You think I'm a fool, but you'd have turned away. You'd have left them to die."
"Aye, I would. But you didn't," he said as he walked past. "That's why there's still hope for you."
"We are none of us responsible for the sins of our fathers," he thought as he went inside. When he was sure nobody could see him, he let a grudging smile cross his lips. "And perhaps we're not doomed to repeat them, either."
51. "There's nothing so fleet as news," thought Overwatchman Clisson, as he watched the hills roll by beyond the carriage window. It was a popular saying among the Ossians, who liked talk for talk's sake, and were never averse to stating the obvious. "And nothing so slow as justice." News of the incident at the Reaver's Rest had been fleet indeed. By now, every settlement within 20 leagues had heard how a road patrol was humiliated and slaughtered there. How the malcontents would be rubbing their hands with glee. Well, let them savour this small act of resistance. Let them gloat at how their masters were given a bloody nose in some backwater den. If the deaths of a dozen soldiers excited them so much, it was only a measure of how powerless they were, how rare their victories. Clisson had other things to worry about. The man once known as Lane of Heath Edge was still alive. Against all odds, he'd evaded the Dreadnights and crossed the mountains. As the saying went, justice moved slowly, and it was long overdue for the ringleader of the Salt Fork Rebellion. But it was coming, and he was bringing it. Clisson shifted on the bench to ease the pain in his tailbone. He'd been sitting still too long. Across from him, Hart gazed mildly out of the window into the clouded day, his face in three-quarter profile. A handsome face, a good Croden face, orderly and firm of features. Clisson loathed the sight of it.
"Did Commander Gosson send you?" he asked silently for the thousandth time. "Who do you work for?"
Hart noticed his gaze and held it arrogantly. There was no deference there.
Anyone would think he was Clisson's superior, rather than the other way around. Perhaps he thought he deserved to be.
Your time will come, Clisson thought.
The trail is 3 days cold, said Hart. We will be fortunate to find them now.
Clisson studied him owlishly through his spectacles.
What would you suggest, Watchman Hart?
He never missed an opportunity to use Hart's title when he could. He needed reminding that he was a mere watchman, and a watchman second class at that. Not an overwatchman like Clisson, and certainly not an overwatchman in line to be commander.
They'll have gone to ground by now, Hart said. Inform our spies, cast the net wide, better than chasing them all over the country.
You don't think our quarry is worth the effort?
There are other ways to hunt him. How many weeks did we waste at Sulla's Bluff waiting to spring your trap?
The trap that didn't catch him. That's what you want to say, isn't it?
I just think we could be doing something more productive for the Empire than this, Hart went on. This land is riddled with sedition, and there are better uses for 3 dreadnoughts and 2 watchmen of the Iron Hand than...
One of us is an overwatchman, Clisson said prissily.
Of course, said Hart.
His defiance was so bald he didn't even blush.
But perhaps, overwatchman, Clisson, we wouldn't be chasing our quarry with quite such vigour if you hadn't rashly staked your career on it in front of Chancellor Draxis himself.
Hart wanted a reaction. Clisson gave him none. It was only a rash move if he failed, and he didn't plan on failing. Saltfork had made the Chancellor nervous, with the wedding and a critical alliance with Harrow so close at hand. By pledging to bring the leader of the rebels to justice, Clisson had publicly thrown his hat in the ring to be the next commander of Ossia, a position that everyone had assumed would go to Gosson's sycophantic second, Oscar Betran. If Clisson could get his man, the Chancellor would be grateful indeed, and Gosson's job would surely be his once the old slug was pensioned off to the motherland.
"You need not worry about my career, Watchman Hart."
Clisson fussed with a button on his sleeve which kept slipping loose. He'd have to see a tailor about that.
"For myself, I thank the Primus the trail is only 3 days cold. What good fortune we were so close. Otherwise, we would have no chance of catching them at all."
The rest didn't need to be said. If they'd heeded Hart's advice and left the fugitives to perish in the mountains, they'd still be west of the Ostenbergs, and the news wouldn't yet have reached them. Despite Hart's protests, Clisson had insisted they travel to Crowbridge, on the east side of the range. In case the fugitives survived the mountains, Clisson wanted to be there waiting for them. And so he was. Hart hadn't missed his meaning. He sniffed and looked out of the window again, trying and failing to hide his frustration.
There, thought Clisson, back in your place for now.
He'd wanted Vekan as his partner on this task. Vekan was a good watchman, and not half so ambitious. But Vekan had been conveniently unavailable, so they'd assigned him Hart instead, who'd been a thorn in his side ever since. Was he Gosson's man or not? Clisson couldn't prove it, but it was always better to err on the side of caution. Long experience had taught him that it paid to be paranoid.
"Watch me, then, if you must," he thought. "Maybe you'll learn something."
They rolled into the stable yard of the Reaver's Rest in the early afternoon, and found soldiers already there. The bodies had been removed, and rain had washed the blood from the cobbles. When the driver opened the door, Hart began to get out, but Clisson leaned across and ensured that he was the first to step down. Small details mattered with Hart. Every day was a battle to keep him from getting above his station. The arrival of a black carriage bearing the double-barred cross inspired a skittish uncertainty in the soldiers, guests, and stable boys alike. They began to wonder if they'd done anything wrong, examining themselves for sedition.
"Just as it should be," thought Clisson,
sweeping the stable yard with a narrow gaze. He wanted to stretch, to relieve his aching muscles after the journey, but he resisted the urge. He was the authority here, and authority didn't ache or tire or become irritated or impatient. Authority was inhuman and perfect. Captain Dressel, the most senior Iron Guardsman to travel with them, presented himself. "Show me the bodies," Clisson said. "Then organize my lunch and send in witnesses. Stable hands, then servants. I'll see the innkeeper last."
"Yes, Overwatchman." Dressel saluted smartly, fist across his chest, and headed off to obey.
Dealing with Dressel was a pleasure in comparison to Hart. He was respectful, trustworthy, capable, and prided himself on doing a good job. Would that there were more like him.
"Why not start with the innkeeper?" Hart said.
"Ever questioning, ever contrary."
"If anyone will know about the guests, it's him. I thought speed was of the essence."
"If he's seen me talk to everyone else first, he'll wonder what they've said, and he won't be tempted to lie or leave anything out in case he contradicts them. You know how people are in Ossia. Misplaced loyalties to the old ways tend to make them less than forthcoming."
"He's Zulan, not Ossian," Hart pointed out. They'd learned as much before they set off.
"His clientele are mostly Ossian, and Ossians don't like informers. He won't be eager to help us. So let's make it easy for him to do the right thing." The bodies of the dead had been wrapped in Hessian and laid out in a barn, away from the inn and guests. Clisson's men uncovered them, and a cleric noted their names while a group of men waited to load them onto a gravedigger's cart. The air was thick with a musty smell, but it had been cool these last few days, and the stench wasn't yet overpowering. Though Clisson had a delicate stomach for food, bad smells and gore didn't bother him. He'd seen enough corpses that they all looked like mannequins now. Some were pierced, some slashed. One, unfortunate, had been decapitated and had an arrow through his cheeks. So many ways to die, but all the same result in the end. Clisson wasn't sure what clue the bodies might reveal, but he was ever thorough and liked to leave no stone unturned. He inspected each of the fallen, noting how they'd died, which had been neatly stabbed, which hacked, and which shot. One among their opponents was clearly an expert swordsman. He killed so tidily that his victims were scarcely marked at all. When he was done, he waved at the men to take them away.
"That was a waste of time," Hart commented as they went back to the inn.
"Time is never wasted in service of the Empire," Clisson said, imagining Hart's corpse being loaded onto the cart with the others. Dressel had set up a booth for him in the common room, and he was brought a meal by a timid servant girl. It was good Croden fare, lamb shanks in rich gravy, stewed greens, nutty yellow potatoes. None of that fussy, overspiced Ossian cooking, or those vile eels they so enjoyed. Once he was ready, he sent Dressel to round up the witnesses in the corridor outside, and had Hart bring them to him.